From Feature Story News in Washington and our bureaus around the world, this is FSN Reports. I'm Kevin McAleese. On today's programme, the United States and Europe ratchet up sanctions against Russia over its part in the ongoing Ukrainian crisis.
It's not a new Cold War. What it is a very specific issue related to Russia's unwillingness to recognise that Ukraine can chart its own path.
Also today we hear from Britain, France and Germany as incidents of anti-Semitism strike as the Gaza war continues. And staying with the conflict, we hear from aid workers on the ground as the civilian death toll rises.
It was the heaviest night ever that all of Gaza left last night. The bombing didn't stop for even a continuous 2 minutes all night.
That's coming up on FSN Reports after our latest summary of the day's headlines.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Simon Marks. The United States and the European Union have unveiled fresh sanctions against Russia in light of the shooting down of Malaysian Airlines Flight 17. Speaking at the White House, President Obama said that the coordinated action between the US and the EU is designed to cause maximum damage to the Russian economy, and he called the downgraded outlook for Russia's economic growth the best tool we have to encourage President Putin to embrace a diplomatic resolution to the Ukraine crisis.
Today, Russia is once again isolating itself from the international community, setting back decades of genuine progress. And it doesn't have to come to this. It didn't have to come to this. It does not have to be this way. This is a choice that Russia, and President Putin in particular, has made.
The European Union sanctions are the toughest measures Brussels has yet taken against Russia. They target the energy, defense, and technology sectors and restrict the access of Russian state-owned banks to capital markets. From FSN's Brussels Bureau, Jack Parrock reports.
EU sanctions to target the economic sectors of finance, military-sensitive equipment, arms, and oil production equipment have been agreed by European Union diplomats. They will affect the Russian state-owned banks from raising finance on European markets. These sanctions will come into effect on Thursday. Jack Parrock, Brussels.
Meanwhile, Washington wants a high-level dialogue with the Kremlin over claims that Russia breached a 1988 nuclear arms treaty. From FSN's bureau in Moscow, Jake Rashbass reports.
The US did not lay out how Russia violated the treaty, but newspaper The New York Times reported earlier this year that Russia had been testing missiles banned by the treaty. The Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty was signed towards the end of the Cold War to ban ground-launched cruise missiles with ranges of 500 to 5,500 kilometers. The accusation comes as tension between Russia and the US is at its highest level since the end of the Cold War, as the two countries accuse each other of stoking the ongoing conflict in eastern Ukraine.
The Israeli bombardment of Gaza has intensified again after Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu warned of a prolonged conflict ahead. More than 100 Palestinians were reportedly killed on Tuesday, and Gaza's only power plant was ablaze after a series of Israeli airstrikes. The Sama Damo of the Save the Children Fund charity is in Gaza City.
Many places have been bombed, have been destroyed, homes as well. The situation and the shelters is unbearable for the people living there as well.
A doctor leading the fight against the Ebola virus in Sierra Leone has himself now died of the disease. Dr. Sheikh Umar Khan is being called a national hero by the country's government. From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN. The British government says it's halving to 3 months the amount of time EU migrants without realistic job prospects can claim government benefits. Prime Minister David Cameron confirmed the tougher stance, saying the magnetic pull of British benefits had to be addressed. From FSN's London Bureau, Dan Whitehead reports.
At the moment, job seekers coming to the UK from the European Union are allowed to claim benefits for 6 months. David Cameron is cutting that down to three if someone fails to prove they have a very clear prospect of gaining employment. The Prime Minister says he wants an immigration system that puts Britain first. With less than a year to go before the general election here in the UK, the Conservatives, led by Mr Cameron, are clearly wanting to be seen to take a tougher stance on this major issue. However, Labour says Mr Cameron's announcement masks a record of failure on immigration.
The United Nations Security Council has imposed sanctions against a North Korean shipping company that was caught smuggling Cuban weapons. The ship was stopped near the Panama Canal last July with missiles and warplanes hidden on board. From FSN's bureau at the UN in New York, Nick Harper reports.
When officials searched the Chongchonggang vessel, they discovered two Soviet-era MiG fighter jets, missiles and air defence systems hidden under bags of sugar. The weapons that came from Cuba were heading for North Korea, leading the UN Sanctions Committee to rule that the shipping company had violated regulations that ban the shipment of arms to North Korea. It means the firm, Ocean Maritime Management, is now subject to travel bans and international asset freezes. Pyongyang claimed the weapons were being shipped to North Korea to be repaired and were going to be returned to Cuba.
There is always more from us on Twitter. You can interact with us there at Feature Story. And that is the latest Feature Story news. Simon Marks reporting.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Kevin McAleese. Welcome to FSN Reports.
Today is a reminder that the United States means what it says. And we will rally the international community in standing up for the rights and freedom of people around the world. Today, and building on the measures we announced 2 weeks ago, the United States is imposing new sanctions in key sectors of the Russian economy: energy, arms, and finance. We're blocking the exports of specific goods and technologies to the Russian energy sector. We're expanding our sanctions to more Russian banks and defense companies. And we're formally suspending credit that encourages exports to Russia and financing for economic development projects in Russia.
President Obama said today's sanctions would inflict further pain on the Russian economy and were the result of the destructive actions of the country and its leader, Vladimir Putin, in the Ukrainian crisis. Mr. Obama insisted the punitive measures did not signal a new Cold War.
What it is a very specific issue related to Russia's unwillingness to recognize that Ukraine can chart its own path. And I think that if you listen to President Poroshenko, if you listen to the Ukrainian people, they've consistently said they seek good relations with Russia. What they can't accept is Russia arming separatists who are carrying out terribly destructive activities inside of Ukraine, thereby undermining the ability of Ukraine to govern itself peacefully. That's something that no country should have to accept.
The EU had earlier announced its toughest sanctions yet against Moscow, also targeting the banking sector, oil firms and defence companies. The sweeping measures from both the US and EU are in response to the Kremlin's ongoing support for pro-separatist rebels in East Ukraine. Jack Parrock is our Europe correspondent.
The European Union has now moved to tier or stage three of sanctions, which is targeting entire sections of the Russian economy. So far, they're looking at oil production equipment, sensitive military equipment, arms, and the financial sector. Now, Russia raised about 7.5 billion euro of bonds on EU financial markets in 2013. So that's going to be quite a big deal for them. This is what came in the proposal back at the Foreign Affairs Council meetings. These sanctions won't be put into place until Thursday, when we're going to find out the finer details of how they're actually going to be implemented.
Jack, can you remind us why the European Union has taken the decision to ramp up their punitive measures against Russia?
All this has been triggered by the downing of MH17, by what the EU says was the pro-Russian separatists in eastern Ukraine. They say that Russia, that there's still a flow of arms and personnel from Russia into eastern Ukraine, and that Russia, that Moscow is still supporting this crisis in eastern Ukraine. And all this comes as the government in Kiev are making an offensive near the crash site of MH17. They're trying to retake the ground and retake the Donetsk region. So it's a very difficult situation at the moment.
And so what's the next step here? What reaction is the EU hoping these sanctions will trigger from Moscow?
Well, the EU hopes that these sanctions are going to force Russia to have to rethink their position on the crisis in eastern Ukraine. They think that if they target Moscow's struggling economy, the IMF, for instance, predicted that the growth is going to drop by about 1% this year, then Russian President Putin will be forced to have a rethink about his actions in eastern Ukraine. It is unclear whether that will happen. So far, the stage two sanctions of putting individuals' names and banks, for instance, specific institutions, putting them on a list of stage two sanctions, which was asset freezes and travel bans, that doesn't seem to have worked. But really what this move is doing is, by the European Union, is trying to show Moscow that they're going to take some more affirmative action now.
Jack Parrock in Brussels. Meanwhile, in Russia, opinions are divided over how much impact new sanctions imposed by the US and European Union might have. Our Moscow correspondent, Tom Barton, reports.
New sanctions have been expected in Russia for some time. A new survey of around 1,600 people across the country by the Levada Center polling organization says that around a third of Russians are worried by sanctions, two-thirds aren't. We spoke to some of them.
I don't care about sanctions because they've got nothing to do with me, a citizen of Russia. They affect businesses, so let the businessmen deal with it.
I don't think these sanctions will affect Russia. We are a strong country. I think there's nothing scary in these sanctions.
Of course we feel sorry in Russia. I feel bad for Putin. Poor him. We're trying so hard, but nothing's happening.
Publicly, it's not hard to hear on the Russian street or from Russian state media the attitude of bluster. But privately, among oligarchs, economists, and some politicians, present and former, the reaction is one of fear. Top Russian individuals and some companies were already the target of EU and US sanctions over the annexation of Crimea and accusations Russia is supporting, supplying and training militants in the east of the country. Now more individuals will follow, and Russia's defence, energy and, perhaps most damagingly, state banking sectors will face restrictions on access to foreign markets and an arms embargo. Andrei Nechayev, a former economy minister in Russia, says Russia's economic situation was already going from bad to worse, even before sanctions.
Russia's economy has been plummeting like a falling bomber plane. The GDP growth has been going down and down and down. As for citizens, they will just feel that the already worsening economy is shifting towards crisis, or that the situation was worsened by sanctions. I think they would not care who's to blame.
Though Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov says Russia will not retaliate or fall into hysterics over mounting sanctions costs, if Russian banks, defence and technology firms start to lose access to more and more international finance and equipment, that may change. Tom Barton, Moscow.
This is FSN Reports. Gaza suffered one of the most intense Israeli military onslaughts Tuesday since the campaign began. Reports say at least 80 people were killed, bringing the death toll to well over 1,000, the majority civilian casualties. A major power plant was among dozens of targets pounded in the Palestinian territory. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu says his country needs to prepare for a long fight against Hamas militants. Save the Children's spokesperson in Gaza, Osama Damo, spoke earlier to LBC Radio.
It was the heaviest night ever that all of Gaza lived last night. The bombing didn't stop for even a continuous 2 minutes all night. What we are seeing now that many places have been bombed, have been destroyed, homes as well. The number of people affected is increasing and doubling every minute. The situation in the shelters is unbearable for the people living there as well.
The thing is, we've heard of shellings of schools, of shelters, of that UN school. Israel have said, as a result, after warnings, their belief that people were not still in those shelters and the like. But obviously, a lot of civilians are losing their lives. In terms of what Save the Children can do to help, what is the main job of your charity workers there?
At the moment, Julia, we are monitoring the situation carefully. We used every opportunity of ceasefire to distribute medications, disposable medical items, as well as hygiene kits, and that includes actually mainly hygiene items for the newborn children and the mothers. In addition to that, first aid kits. But also at the same time, while Save the Children is scaling up its response in the psychosocial support to be given to the children, in light of more than 196,000 children are reported in urgent need for psychosocial support, and also our scaling up to the water and sanitation rehabilitation of the destroyed networks, without a long-term end of violence in the region, we will not be able to do that. All of this emergency work and the intervention and the long-term work with the children and their families needs actually a ceasefire in order to, because this is a month of response. It needs an immediate ceasefire now, and the need is very huge at the moment, Julia. It will be Save the Children and all other agencies responding immediately once the ceasefire is announced.
Save the Children's spokesperson in Gaza, Osama Damo, talking to Julia Hartley-Brewer on LBC Radio. Now, there have been large demonstrations in many European capitals opposing Israel's ground offensive and expressing sympathy for the Palestinian cause. In Britain yesterday, a leading player of the normally sedate game of cricket found himself under investigation for breaking the sport's ban on political messaging. He was wearing a Save Gaza wristband while playing an international match. A singer with the pop group One Direction has received death threats after pledging his support for Palestine in social media last week. But death threats cut both ways, and in many European countries, Jewish communities are reporting a sudden spike in acts of anti-Semitism since the Israeli ground offensive began. In Britain, a doubling from an average of 50 reported anti-Semitic attacks per month to more than 100 in July alone. Nick Ferrari of Britain's LBC Radio explored the situation in France, Germany and Britain, speaking first with Justin Cohen, editor of the British newspaper The Jewish News.
Yes, as you say, there's been a shocking doubling of anti-Semitic attacks during the course of July. This is since the start of the operation. A lot of these incidents are shown to have a direct link to the operation. We've seen rabbis being attacked outside Jewish schools in Gateshead. We've seen bricks thrown through the windows of a Belfast synagogue. And we've seen daubings across London, including at two residential properties. A swastika was daubed yesterday afternoon.
I mean, this is ridiculous, because while some people might question the wisdom of the Israeli state's actions in what's going on in Gaza, to take it out against innocent Jewish people would seem to be a pretty low blow, Justin.
Absolutely. I think that, unfortunately, whenever there is a flare-up of violence in the Middle East, there's a backlash against the British Jewish community, and indeed, as you mentioned, across Europe. We've seen this during Operation Cast Lead in 2008-2009, when actually the number of incidents was even worse than it is at the moment. But there is a conflation made between those who are of that mindset, between Israelis and Jews, so that any Jew around the world is seen as somehow involved with and responsible for the actions of the Israeli government in its operation against Hamas.
Lastly and briefly, if you can, Justin, what measures are Jewish people taking? I know that you have the CSI, don't you?
The CST,
CST
the
I'm so sorry. CST, Community Security Trust, I'm sorry.
Absolutely. They are advising people to remain vigilant, to stay on alert, to make reports to both them and the police of incidents, but at the same time are urging people not to be alarmist.
Let's go to Jonathan Arfi, who's Vice President of the Representative Council of Jewish Institutions in France. What is the situation for Jewish people in that particular country, Jonathan?
Yes, thank you for your interest in the French Jewish affairs. We have witnessed a lot of attacks against the Jewish population in France and against the synagogues. For instance, over the last two weekends, we have had We have had a lot of pro-Palestinian demonstrations, which turned into attacks against, for instance, 8 synagogues, a total of 8 synagogues over the last 2 weekends. So there is a growing concern among the Jewish population in France that these attacks will continue, and even if we had a strong and full support from the public authorities and from the police.
And what measures are Jewish people taking in France then?
Like in the UK, we have sent messages to the Jewish population saying to be vigilant, and we also have to trust, of course, the work of the police and justice authorities in France. So we have a strong collaboration with the cooperation with the Ministry of Interior, and we hope it will be enough to contain the level of violence.
Justin Hugler, what was the situation in Germany? How is it playing out there? Good morning.
Good morning. Well, it's causing a huge amount of controversy in Germany. You've had twice in the past week in Berlin, you've had Jewish people attacked on the streets for no reason other than being visibly Jewish. In both cases, there were men wearing a traditional Jewish skull cap. And in the first case, he happened to walk close to a group of protesters, completely unsuspecting. It was a tourist from Israel, and they turned and charged towards him, shouting, "Jew will get you." And the Berlin police had to intervene to protect him and his wife and prevent them from being attacked. And a few days later, a young 18-year-old Jewish man living in Berlin was attacked and punched in the face for no reason, and the suspicion is because, again, he was wearing a skull cap.
This is a terribly difficult question to answer because there's no real way to quantify it, but how safe does the average Jewish man or woman feel in Germany or in Berlin at this time, Justin?
Well, I think with incidents like that, they must be feeling a lot less safe than usual. I think that we've also seen a lot of very disturbing slogans on the street, as has been happening in other European countries.
Justin Hugel in Germany, ending that look at rising anti-Semitism in Europe. He was talking to Nick Ferrari of Britain's LBC Radio. And finally tonight, FSN Spotlight. And with that, here's Simon Marks.
Today on FSN Spotlight, the link between social protest movements and design. That's the subject of a new exhibition in London at the Victoria and Albert Museum, and it's also the subject of this week's essay by Peter Aspden, the arts correspondent with the Financial Times.
Mounting a protest can be a tricky business. I remember reporting in the 1980s a campaign by university lecturers to improve their conditions of work. Their very erudition may have hampered their cause. The stirring slogan they chose to win round the masses was, "Rectify the anomaly." I can still picture the none too prepossessing young man holding a placard by the side of the A4, pulling the deadened gazes of weary commuters driving out of London towards his convoluted message. Marxist revolution was surely round the corner. But it didn't turn out that way. The political establishment managed to survive that devastating threat to its authority. The anomaly, whatever it was, lived on. It would be nice to think that there is a stash of Rectify t-shirts to be found in the basement of a former polytechnic somewhere, a legacy to that bone-rattling call to arms. It would have made a fine addition to the Victoria and Albert Museum's new exhibition, Disobedient Objects. The show illustrates how the battle for hearts and minds has evolved over the last quarter of a century, and how the once simplistic art of social protest has acquired its own refinements and sophistication as it has moved with the times. It begins in the late 1970s, a time which many would consider to be well past the golden age of protest. The handsome Che Guevara posters, the students placing flowers inside the guns of soldiers, the pregnant lyrics of chart-topping pop songs, "Call out the instigators," sang Thunderclap Newman, "because there's something in the air." All these pivotal cultural moments belong to the previous decade. The 1970s, widely regarded as a hangover decade, was when protest discovered its limits rather than celebrating its potential. And yet, whatever it lost in directness and militancy, it was beginning to gain in practical wisdom. The artists and designers of the post-60s sensibility employed a richer palette of tone than their predecessors. They used drama, the striking life-sized puppets of the US's bread and puppet theatre, promoting democratic culture and bread baking as antidotes to high capitalism. They appropriated high art. China's Goddess of Democracy torch-bearing statuette, based not as commonly thought on the Statue of Liberty, but on the Soviet sculpture Kolkhoz Woman. The original was constructed and then destroyed by a tank in Tiananmen Square. The cheap copy is to be found in the home of many a dissident of the regime. Samizdat kitsch or revolutionary totem. Protests against baton-wielding police forces gained poignancy when students began to use shields that were painted as book covers, a tactic first seen in Italy in the last decade. It seemed, as police moved against them, that the forces of law and order were clubbing the life out of Boccaccio and Dante themselves. This was protest designed to be observed through technology's rapid dissemination of images. Social media created instant icons, and here were political malcontents moving as sure-footedly as any high-flying brand consultant. In Berlin and Barcelona, demonstrators used giant cube-shaped cobblestone inflatables, which they would float towards police lines. The authorities were faced with a conundrum of absurdity. Did they pretend to ignore them as they landed haplessly among them? Or did they bounce them back to the demonstrators, farcically turning a serious engagement into a game of beach volleyball? Humour has become a powerful weapon. Dissident acts are designed to raise a wry smile rather than a howl of outrage. In the US, a graffiti-writing robot took the pain, and perhaps the fun, out of spraying slogans on walls. Here, surely, was alternative culture's counterpart to drone missiles, the double-edged critique deftly made. Recent demonstrations in Britain, never a country to stray far from a joke, have seen withering epigram placards denouncing government spending cuts. "I wish my boyfriend was as dirty as your policies," says one. In Russia, a rainbow-coloured "We won't give it to Putin a third time" placard is replete with sexual innuendo. These absurdist and ironic twists were all very well, I said to the show's co-curators, Catherine Flood and Gavin Grinden, but were they effective? Grinden believes they symbolise a new realism about the limits of social protest. In the 1960s, he says, there was a higher expectation of immediate change. Now there is no less utopianism around, but there is a much stronger sense of having to be strategic. Protesters, in other words, are in it for the long haul. The explosive shows of dissent that shook the 1960s brought issues such as race and gender to government agendas. But it was the consolidation of those protests in the following decades that won the battles. Today, going viral is more important than going to the barricades. And the instigators need to be more artful than ever.
Peter Aspden of the Financial Times, and that exhibition, Disobedient Objects, is on at the Victoria and Albert Museum in London until the 1st of February next year. We air Peter Aspden's essays regularly here on FSN Reports. You can read his coverage of arts and culture every day in the newspaper and on its website at ft.com. With FSN Spotlight, I'm Simon Marks.
And that's the Tuesday edition of FSN Reports. If you'd like to tell us what you think of the show, email us reports@featurestory.com. That's reports@featurestory.com. And you can follow us on Twitter. We're there at Feature Story. But for now, I'm Kevin McAleese in Washington, alongside Simon Marks with The Bulletin. For everyone with FSN everywhere, have a great evening. Goodbye.